Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Reminder, you can subscribe to us on Apple's iTunes. You can subscribe to us on Stitcher, Google Play. And if you want to leave a positive comment, we're quite grateful. We're joined again by one of our favorite contributors, A.B. Stoddard, who is an associate editor of Real Clear Politics and a columnist. Thanks for coming back in.
Thanks for having me, Charlie.
So we haven't talked since you had that big story for us in the Bulwark last week about the Georgia senator who almost alone among Republican senators decided to stand up and push back against President Trump's attacks on John McCain, Johnny Isaacson.
Yeah, it was notable for so many reasons. One is that Johnny Isaacson in August when Senator McCain died took to the Senate floor. He's not a grandstander. He doesn't seek publicity. He, you know, stays really in the shadows on purpose, in the chamber and, is a low key guy, but had taken to the floor after McCain's passing because he was so upset by the fact that the White House first had not put the flag at half staff, then had put it there, but put it right back up, and that, like Johnny Isaacson, who is the chairman of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, had to express their displeasure with the administration to make them understand that the flag was to be left at half staff until the completion of internment and the burial that ended up being that Sunday, maybe 5 days later. And then the White House responded. But, he gave a speech talking about how John McCain was better than him, and that, John McCain, that he was he had joined the National Guard, Isaacson had. But he did it in order to spare himself service in Vietnam, and that he was not as brave as John McCain and as selfless as his friend, his best friend growing up, a guy named Jack Cox, who died in Vietnam. And it's an amazing speech. And he said anyone who denigrates the legacy of John McCain deserves a whipping. So he put it out there as a placeholder. And I think he hoped he would never have to follow up on that promise. But then after the president went back at Senator John McCain, 7 months after his death, Johnny Isaacson knew that he had to deliver on that promise. So he did. He spoke to me first, which we printed here in the Bulwark. And then the next, he basically told me he was going to be speaking about it with Atlanta Press in Georgia on public broadcasting radio the next day. And he basically said, you know, in so much as what he told me, not as much actually as what he told me that we had in the Bulwark, but he made his point. By then, because the news had gone out and sort of startled people out of their, you know, shameful, fearful complicity, you saw a bunch of tweets right away after the story appeared here from Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Mitt Romney and Senator McSally, who sits in the McCain seat and is, you know, going to be in a very tough reelection fight after she was appointed to that seat, after she lost to Kyrsten Sinema, and is obviously still afraid of the Republican primary voters of Arizona. So they all came out with these tweets saying that John McCain was a hero and they think about him every day. And they didn't talk about what Senator Isaacson said, which was that the McCain family deserves better. John McCain deserves better. Our veterans deserve better. This country deserves better. We're better than this. And really, you know, directly took the president to task for kicking a dead POW 7 months after we lost him. And so I'm stunned, Charlie, that, you know, here a long week later, or whatever it's been, I guess it's only been a week, that no one no one has done what Senator Isaacson felt he had to do, the lone voice as the Senate Veteran Affairs Committee chairman speaking for these people who sacrifice for our freedom.
And you really did think that there was a moment there that maybe the dam would break, that he was going to shame his colleagues into doing it. I mean, he's not at the top of the list of people who call out President Trump, and yet complete silence. And then you had this bizarre interview with Lindsey Graham, who basically said, look, McCain's one of my dearest friends. It's okay for McCain and Donald Trump to disagree. The bottom line here is I'm going to help President Trump. I'll honor my friend until the day I die. But this president feels like people around McCain were out to get him. John McCain wasn't. And then he basically says, the only reason you're asking me about this is, you know, this people who hate the president, all those people who bring up this narrative, you just hate Trump. You don't really care about McCain and me. It was like, wow. I mean, it really did sort of encapsulate all of the compromises that, Republicans like Lindsey Graham have made, that, he cannot bring himself just to have a sentence or a paragraph on John McCain.
Right. And that is, I mean, I think Lindsey Graham's made it clear to us that he wants to help the president and believes that he's helping him by putting up with this type of abuse of John McCain. And that comes with the package. He's made that clear before. But it, as you said, if he was his best friend and he got up on the Senate floor, you know, that same week as Senator Isaacson did and told us how hard a time this was going to be for him, to carry on, you know, without his friend, that he couldn't just say, you know, that the gift that John McCain gave this country, you know, can't be matched, is beyond our imagination. He had summoned courage that, you know, none of us can really even contemplate. Refused early release as a prisoner. All these things that Lindsey Graham has looked up to John McCain for. You'd think that he could just say that John McCain's legacy should never be denigrated the way that the Senator Isaacson did, without feeling that he had to also make Trump feel better in the same comments.
And had he done so, would that have been a divorce from Trump world? Would he have lost the Republican primary in South Carolina next year? I don't think so.
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. Okay, let's talk about what's going on this week. Of course, you had a hugely good weekend for the president with the release of the Barr report. We still have not seen the Mueller report. I want to underline that several times. We still do not know what's in that. But then you had the president apparently feeling his oats, turning around and deciding that he is going to flip the administration's position on Obamacare, that now the official position of the Department of Justice and the administration is to support this Texas federal judge who has basically ruled that with the repeal of the tax, the penalty for not having insurance, that therefore there is no validity to Obamacare. So wipe it off, Medicaid expansion, pre-existing conditions, protection, coverage of young people, all of that gone. How are people on Capitol Hill responding to that?
Well, I spoke to several Republicans yesterday who, you know, they just burst out laughing. It is a complete and utter political nightmare for them, as was made clear by the minority leader on the House side, Kevin McCarthy, who had to go to the president and say, this was not something we had planned on, and this is really going to be tough for us. If you're a senator up for reelection next year in a difficult state, and you did not suffer the pain of healthcare as an issue in the midterms and live to make it back to Capitol Hill, as some House, you know, some House Republicans did, like Will Hurd, Brian Fitzpatrick, John Katko, and you're up in Georgia, you're up in Texas, you're up in Iowa, in Arizona, and North Carolina, I don't know what you say. Cory Gardner's up in Colorado, a state Hillary won. He's saying, oh, well, they're all doing this happy talk, which I know you've probably already chuckled at, Charlie, where they're like, he's just getting out in front of this issue. And, you know, Congress has to do its job. I mean, this is the thing that they keep talking about. Mick Mulvaney, the chief of staff, Senator Graham, is like, it'll be no problem. They can go back to Graham Cassidy, which was a proposal on the table for a block grant to the states. It's really going to make conservatives happy. And it'll be great because now they don't have John McCain and they have all these Senate seats and a bigger majority on the Senate side, denying the fact that they've lost control of the House to Democrats, and that
not in detail. Yeah, not a trivial detail there, that they no longer have a House of Representatives that's going to give them what they want.
So this is – so basically the people who were involved at the end stage negotiations on this, when Senator Lamar Alexander and Senator Patty Murray tried to do an Affordable Care Act stabilization plan, which no one ever put on the floor and never passed, they told me yesterday, you know, this Graham Cassidy thing is not even on – it's not even remotely on the table. So you'll hear Republicans cling to that and their talking points because there isn't a plan, but we're back to, you know, maybe, like I said, the Alexander Murray stabilization for the exchanges that again, you couldn't pass in an all-Republican government.
So, I mean, this seems like a long shot legally as well as politically. I mean, I'm trying to think what the positive endgame from Trump's point of view is, other than that he gets to use this as an applause line at his rallies, because it seems unlikely that the federal courts are going to go along with completely wiping this out. And then, of course, if they did, you have the political nightmare of trying to get legislation through a divided Congress. So, you know, I always try to get inside the head of the decision makers, except with Donald Trump, that's too scary a place for me. But inside the room, you have the Attorney General reportedly saying don't do this. You have the Secretary of Health and Human Services saying don't do this. You have the congressional leaders saying don't do this. What was Mick Mulvaney thinking? And did they actually game out the way this was going to play, especially given what a devastating issue this was for Republicans in 2018?
Right. Well, a couple things I wanted to add, Vice President Mike Pence, to your list. Supporting invalidating it only if there was a plan in place, and there's no plan in place. So a long list of people weighing in against this move. And then you have Mick Mulvaney, the chief of staff, as you said, a former member of the House Freedom Caucus, basically telling Trump, this is your chance. Like you said, an applause line. He's very hung up on promises kept. And so he's going to tell us there's like 2,000 miles of wall built already, and it's impenetrable, and it's real. And he wants to say he repealed Obamacare. And the idea, I'm sure Mick Mulvaney just, you know, appealed to him on this, this attraction, you know, primarily, which was you can finally do this. You can do this. And as a Freedom Caucus member, you know, Mick Mulvaney's probably super excited about dismantling it. You know, I understand constitutionally and legally the argument about the tax, and I really do. I mean, you know, you can see the legal argument, right? So he appealed to Trump on this. Look, you know, this can't stand, and we've got to get rid of it. And maybe he said to him that Congress easily passes laws that they haven't been able to pass before, and it'll be no problem in presidential election years. But if Trump thought about it for a while, he'd see that he was vulnerable. Yeah. He might actually be making the calculation, which I think is astonishing, Charlie, that if the courts were to invalidate it, and I don't think that they will, I agree with you, that if they were to, and Congress still hadn't come up with a plan, that he would tell us next summer, well, you know, I'm just got a campaign. You have to reelect me because we need to come up with good health care. And I promise it'll be the best, but the most cheap and so affordable, and government subsidies for all, and everything he's promised along the way, while telling us that the boogeyman of the socialist left trying to turn everything into Medicare for all is the real danger. Maybe he thinks there's actually sort of a feasible plan without a replacement and just the promise kept on repeal. It doesn't make sense to me, but that's really what it was. It was, I get the promise checked banner behind me at the rally, and if we lose the Senate majority in the process, so be it.
Wow. So do you think there's a possibility he'll back off from this? We've seen this before, where the president gets out in front and then people, you know, tell him this is not workable. And any chance that they'll find a way to walk this back?
Oh, I think there's always a chance of that. I do. I don't know how legally, once you've affirmed a court ruling, you can walk that back. But the president, you know, look at withdrawing troops from Syria and other things, and all the different positions he's taken on healthcare. Let's pass it with a Rose Garden ceremony, then call it mean. I mean, he could go anywhere he wants because he has.
You had a piece this week, and I think is going to be interesting about this discussion is I had Josh Kroshauer from National Journal on yesterday, and I think that you and he take very different positions on all of this. Your piece is two gifts for Democrats if they will take them, and the two gifts are, and I'm sure Democrats are going to agree with this. Number one, the quote unquote clearing. I put quotation marks around there. Can you see me with the fingers doing anything? Of the president by the Mueller/Barr report, and then of course what we've been talking about here. So why do you think this is a gift for Democrats? that the Mueller report did not turn out to be the Deus ex Mueller that they were all expecting.
I like that one, Charlie. Okay, I stole this it from somebody. I really feel strongly about this, and just because Democrats, you know, may not be able to see it, doesn't mean that they're right. The fact that Barr came down and interceded and said, look, it's clear, we haven't seen the Mueller report, but it's clear that Bob Mueller had probably evidence both for obstruction and against, and he decided to not make a decision. He left it up to the Attorney General, or planned to leave it to Congress, and the Attorney General stepped in.
Right.
But because of that, now there will never be a Senate conviction, period. So if there had been an actual charge of obstruction, that might have shamed someone in a Clinton state, like Susan Collins or Cory Gardner. That might have been really tough once the details came out, right? If there was a House impeachment. Now they are precluded. They can't do an impeachment that would, you know, that could boomerang just in the House, a partisan impeachment of one chamber turned down by the Senate. They can't do it. It's a political trap. And hey, actually, details could come out that are really tough for this president. Evidence of collusion, which is not conspiracy. Everyone at home, please read Kim Whaley on the Bulwark today and understand the difference. There was plenty of collusion. Charles Krauthammer, July of 2017, bungled collusion is still collusion. Collusion is not conspiracy. It is not a crime. So they didn't find evidence to meet the level of coordination and conspiracy that would have constituted a crime. And there might be obstruction. Next year, some Democratic nominee can run around saying there was collusion and probably obstruction. There just wasn't conspiracy. And guess what? The fact that there wasn't conspiracy is really important, and it's a super positive thing. I'm sure you agree, Charlie, that if we were sitting here right now contemplating the fact that an elected U.S. president had actually rigged his election with a foreign adversary, it's something I don't know that the country could recover from.
Oh, so, I agree with you
so
completely.
They go into the campaign minus the trap of impeachment, minus the trauma to the country, and able to say there was collusion and probably obstruction, and then you have the healthcare thing. I think those, if they're smart, they will know that that's the path to winning next year. It's to talk about people's families, to not talk about Trump, and to be able to. There will be all of these surrogates out there with all of the dirty details that we learn from all these House oversight hearings and whatever we learn from the Mueller report. You know, all the stuff we already know, which is really bad. But you don't get into a partisan impeachment that can help reelect the president.
Okay. I thought you were going to take a different position than Josh. Actually, the more I think about it, I think you're saying the same thing, that you have two tracks. The presidential candidates can run on the economy and other issues, where the Democrats in Congress will continue to push the issues of the president's behavior and character out there. You know, his main point was, you know, if you look at the basics of the economy and the pocketbook issues right now, they would seem to favor Donald Trump. The economy is good. Unemployment. Is down. Wages are rising. People are feeling pretty good. You know, even you, if you find Trump as opposed to the you know, out there scary stuff that you're seeing from some of the Democrats. So his point was, if you don't make Donald Trump's character a key issue, then in effect you've normalized him, and in a normal election, he's going to have the high ground.
I understand. I mean, I agree. Look, I think we've all read, you know, all of the analysis recently about how the economy is going to reelect Trump if it stays stable. And there's no question that post Mueller, he is in a stronger position. And that's what I said in the piece. Democrats have to accept this is no longer a referendum. It's a choice election. And in a choice in a good economy, the president can get reelected. That said, he's no longer an outsider. He has a record. He did disrupting. He's disrupted healthcare. It is the number one issue. It was in the midterms, and it will be. It's the number one political liability for Republicans and President Trump. So if you run as a party, you know, focused on people's problems and not talk about Donald Trump, but at the same time, the Congress does its constitutionally mandated oversight that the Republicans refused to do. And we learn whether or not he actually committed financial crimes as a businessman, whether or not he might be, compromised by the Putin government. What led to the fact that Jared Kushner really couldn't get a security clearance, but then he did anyway. And what are his relationships with you know, the Qataris and the Saudis, and while he's making national, you know, security decisions, all of these things should be, they should be investigated. And so as long as, there is a focus on the campaign trail, on solutions and all that kind of stuff. Even in a strong economy, they have a chance if they talk mostly about healthcare, an issue that I just don't think will be resolved by November of 2020.
No, and of course that's what worked in 2018 for all of them. You know, it is interesting that you anytime you talk to elected officials anywhere in the country, they will say the same thing, that that their constituents are not talking about Russia. They're not talking about Mueller. We may be talking about Mueller and Russia all the time. Cable television may have built their ratings on talking about Mueller and Russia, but most people are talking about these other things. And the this decision to go after the, you know, if, you know, have it wiped off the book, is going to put it right on the front burner for, you know, tens of millions of people. And in a lot of ways, kind of the, you know, the worst case scenario for Republicans. Here's another question. I'm actually torn on Betsy DeVos, because I think that, you know, I think she's, you know, in way over her head, but I think she's got some good instincts and has some good policies. And yet right now, the Department of Education and the budget is being defined by the decision to cut all of the funding for Special Olympics. If you had a laboratory to come up with the most distasteful, unpopular idea in the world, it would be that. How many people picked up the newspaper and saw, you know, that the Trump administration is going to cut Special Olympics and thought, oh, damn right. Yeah, it's about time we did that sort of thing.
Right.
Now, and this is not the first time they've done this, right? Isn't this like the third time they propose cutting funding for Special Olympics?
I don't know, but it's you are right that it's such a headline grabber, that, and it's so unpopular and controversial, that it makes whatever other reforms they're suggesting, you know, completely. I mean, no one's going to know about them. No one's going to listen. It's just overwhelmed by the headline about Special Olympics. And that's.
But that's totally predictable. So why didn't they predict it?
We have so many questions about the Trump administration, Charlie. Mm-hmm. I mean, look what just happened with his tweet on North Korea sanctions and the story surrounding that. I mean, look, this is not the first time that they've done something that looks boneheaded. Starting with our conversation here, he got to brag about the Mueller report. I mean, the Barr summary clearing him of these things. And then they did their healthcare thing, you know, right away, stepped on the message. And then we went into Special Olympics cuts. It's kind of, I mean, it's beyond crazy in terms of.
It is extraordinary. No, I mean, I'm a fiscal conservative, and I've complained about the deficits and the debt. So, you know, in theory, you know, anywhere you can cut spending is a good idea, except that just from a prudential political point of view, if you sat down in any room of normal people and somebody said, well, hey, we give, what, $18 million to Special Olympics, somebody in the room would raise their hand and say, that is the worst idea. I mean, you understand exactly how this will play out, and then we'll describe exactly how this is playing out. And Betsy DeVos is just handling it horribly. I mean, you saw her statement that she put out yesterday?
Yeah, that's the problem, is she's very
it's awful.
She's very kind of tone deaf with her responses generally. And there was a while where the people in the administration last year were getting – she was, you know, in the hot seat, and they were getting – he doesn't like bad headlines. So he doesn't like attention paid to cabinet secretaries flubbing tweets or interviews or anything. And so there was a time where they thought, oh, you know, maybe we should find someone else. And then, like many things in the Trump administration, other fires elsewhere, you know, kind of overtook events, and she got to stay, much like Kirstjen Nielsen at DHS. But she's not the slickest knife in the drawer.
No, that statement that you put out, which attacked the media for its erroneous, false reports, and then goes on for like three or four paragraphs, and then basically acknowledges that, yeah, we're cutting all the funding for Special Olympics.
Well, blame the media. Okay. Is like, that's the first thing that you, I mean, that's what you're supposed to do if you work in this administration. It's like the start of every answer or rebuttal or response or explanation is that the media has once again lied about what we're trying to do.
You know, this is also not surprising, I guess, when you think about it, that the overwhelming response on the conservative media and in Trump world to the president's quote unquote non-exoneration, I'm making the quote marks again, was this lashing, this vindictive lashing out, the immediate calls to target the Democrats, turn things around, and basically to start what you would normally describe as a witch hunt against people who had been, you know, supportive of this investigation. I guess I say it's not surprising because this is their mode, but you would have think there would have been more happiness and that they would have reveled in it longer before they basically threw the kerosene on.
I think that they know there is a potential that this was a pause, a sort of a chance to frame this before the actual real findings are in, which might embarrass the president and his family. I think they are doing this proactively in anticipation of something like this. And also because there are still potentially other investigations that could cause the president to face legal exposure or his family coming out of the Southern District of New York. And to paint everything from now on, no matter what it is, as fraudulent and fake and outrageous. And it's really twisted, but that kind of vengeful kind of and vehement response, I think, was really intentional. So is the idea of the House Republicans on intelligence attacking the chairman, Adam Schiff, after Devin Nunes made himself a national embarrassment. I have laughed with House Republicans in the last year and a half over the comportment and the conduct of the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee under Republican control last cycle, Devin Nunes, running to the White House, all of his capers. I mean, this is the most, it was laughable. He had to recuse himself from his own investigation. And now they've decided that they have to be mad at Adam Schiff because he's pointing out what Kim Whaley pointed out in her piece on The Bulwark. There was collusion. And these things, I still want to know as a taxpayer, Charlie, I don't care who in this country is not following the Mueller investigation. I want to know what Konstantin Kilimnik and Paul Manafort were doing together. Mm-hmm. Why the point?
That was seems reasonable.
That was part of a Mueller finding where redaction, none of Paul Manafort's chargings or sentencing have anything to do with him colluding with Russians. I need to know about that. I want to know about what happened with Cambridge Analytica. I want to know what happened with Stone and WikiLeaks. We deserve these answers. And so, and why did the president lie about the Trump Tower Moscow? So Adam Schiff is now, because they want to intentionally distract from the fact that Adam Schiff wants to get back to whether or not the president, his loans from Russian oligarchs or whoever the Russians were in the 2000s, if that indeed has compromised him and his family to the Putin government now, the House Republicans, you know, got their talking points or their plans, to come out and try to make Adam Schiff the shiny object. Yeah. It's so intentional, but like you, I'm surprised by the sort of the level of intensity.
But I understand that strategy. I mean, I find it distasteful, but I understand it in many ways because Adam Schiff has been the public face of the of this investigation and has been a very, very effective critic of the president. So, you know, take him out, destroy his credibility, make him the target is at least I get that strategy as opposed to not getting the, you know, why healthcare was such a smart idea. The other thing I've been thinking about is that the president has been fortunate in some of his critics, including people like Michael Avenatti. Did we ever on a cable show with Michael Avenatti?
I sort of pass through makeup rooms with him.
Yeah.
And
okay.
I agree with you. I mean, Michael Avenatti is a train wreck, and it is, you could see the delight and the celebration of Avenatti going down right after the Barr summary came in.
Oh my God. But why did it take so long for people? I mean, I should actually do a Google search on this. He must have been on cable television, 200 times? I mean, he was a superstar. I mean, I want to talk about a trajectory up and down. And yet there is this pattern where I think, you know, and I do think that, you know, Trump skeptics need to have a little bit of introspection. You know, the enthusiasm with which they embraced the Michael Wolff book, which turned out to be a tissue of errors and false innuendos, the embrace for a week of Omarosa, and then the whole Avenatti phenomenon, which is that if you have somebody that comes along and he confirms your bias, he confirms your worst suspicions, you're going to glom onto him no matter how many legitimate questions ought to have been raised. I mean, in retrospect, this guy had so many red flags over him, and yet, let's face it, you know, Democrats embraced him, the media embraced him. He was a superstar until he stopped being a superstar. And the role that he played in the Kavanaugh hearings, I think really cannot be overstated, just screwing things up for the Democrats by coming forward with a completely bogus, completely uncredible charge at the last minute. So, you know, I don't sense a lot of sympathy for him right now, but the phenomenon that catapulted him to the top, I do think deserves to be analyzed a little bit more.
Well, if you go back to lonely, crusty town halls of Jeb Bush's and John Kasich's that were not well attended and then couldn't get any cable news coverage, while we watched the start of rallies for 40 minutes before Trump appeared on stage, exactly, and then carried an hour and a half of them live, this is the problem, is that Trump, the spectacle, has set the expectation for clicks and excitement and audience and ratings and all this kind of thing. Avenatti was that shiny object that people, you know, couldn't stop listening to and watching. And he was given way too much airtime. And so were Trump rallies in 2016. But that's where we are. And it's going to be, you know, I don't expect it to be reversed. And that's going to be a really interesting part of the Democratic campaign, is that the dud candidates are going to be aching for some coverage of their events, even well-attended events, while, you know, Beto, like, sweating on top of, you know, like, bakery tables is going to be aired more, and people are, and then the, you know, cameras are going to go out and show that there's like three parking lots outside of people waiting to come into this tiny, you know, and it's like nothing happens, but he's more exciting than Elizabeth Warren.
Well, just advice for both sides of the political spectrum. Don't fall in love with grifters and trolls. Yeah. Just restrain yourself. Just remember that as journalists, you ought to look at everybody with a gimlet eye. A.B. Stoddard, thank you so much for joining me and spending time. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks so much, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.